Item one, the Fed. Are we safer today than we were 8 years ago? Hint, yes. Item two, China. Big, big meeting this week. And item three, infrastructure lessons from the past from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 3rd of April, if you can believe that. Great as always to have you along, everybody. Here are a couple of phrases with which we will begin the program today. Too big to fail. That's an old standby. Systemic risk, another oldie but goodie. How about financial stability? All three of those, regulation of the financial system and yet a fourth phrase, have been the primary focus of Federal Reserve Board Governor Daniel Tarullo these past 8 years. Wednesday, though, is his last day at the Fed. So we got him on the phone to talk about his time at the central bank. Mr. Tarullo, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Why are you leaving now? Your term runs for another number of years.
Well, you know, Kai, I've been at the Fed for over 8 years now. I came in with a group of people with the intention of trying to get a set of things done to make a safer and sounder financial system. And I think we've collectively made a lot of progress towards that end. And I think there just comes a point where everybody, for their own purposes, should probably move on and do something else. And I just felt it was the right time for me to do so.
I'm going to put some words in your mouth here, but we'll see how this goes. Are you declaring victory and departing the field on your regulatory goals when you join the Fed?
No, not at all. I mean, I think the dangers come when anybody declares victory, probably on any policy issue, but certainly in financial regulation, because as you know, the financial system is a constantly adaptive one, and so regulation needs also to be adaptive. Now, I just think we achieved a set of specific concrete goals that we wanted to achieve, particularly with respect to building up the capital and liquidity positions of our largest banks. And although there's going to be a need to refine what's been put in place and adapt those regulations over time, I did think this was a good point for me to leave.
You're satisfied now, just to put it in the vernacular, that the big banks have enough money in the bank to weather another storm?
Well, I think that we have definitely strengthened the financial system substantially. You know, I think there might be an argument for a little bit higher capital requirements for the very biggest banks. But if you look at where we are today compared to where we were 7 or 8 or 9 years ago, it's just a much stronger financial system.
I'll tell you what, take me back then, would you, to early-ish 2009 when you joined the Fed. You walk in the door and Ben Bernanke goes, oh, my God, am I glad to see you, right?
Well, sure. I think everybody was looking for help anywhere they could find it. And just to take your listeners back to late 2008, when we were in transition from the election to early 2009, remember what was happening at the time. I mean, Kai, you probably did programs where people were talking about whether the financial system needed to be nationalized.
You bet.
And so faced with the complete lack of confidence in the financial system, faced with the fact that we had had to inject taxpayer capital into all of our largest institutions, we had two jobs. The first was try to restore public confidence in the financial system. And second, after we did that, was to try to make sure that we put the financial system on a footing where the risks of that kind of calamity would be much, much lower.
Let me extend that then from the financial system, which you are directly in charge of, to the economy writ large. Are we economically now, not financial system, but are we safer and better off now than we were in 2009?
Well, certainly we're better off than we were in 2009. I mean, again, our economy was hemorrhaging jobs. We were on the way to what turned out to be the deepest recession since the Great Depression. And obviously, we're in a substantially better position than we were then. I think, though, that notwithstanding 6 or 7 years of steady, if unspectacular, growth, we're all still focused on the fact that we're not achieving growth levels that existed in the economy, even in the somewhat pre-crisis period. And we do have the question of inequality, which has been hanging over the economy for a long time. But I think people have focused on it more since the crisis.
Well, so but here's the thing, just continuing in that thought. I mean, we go out, I personally and our reporters obviously go out and do reporting trips. But I've been to Alabama and Oregon and all over this country. And people aren't feeling the stability and the safety that the Fed, yourself here now, and Chair Yellen, certainly in her public remarks, is talking about. What is that disconnect between actual people in the economy and what y'all are doing?
Well, I think, you know, it's difficult for any one of us to say with assurance why that's the case. But let me just offer you at least one thought. I mean, you and I both know a lot of people who grew up in the Depression. And as we know, a lot of people who grew up in the Depression have had an attitude towards savings and towards economic stability and job security that was very much shaped by that period of their lives. And I suspect we're seeing in somewhat lesser form a repeat of that. People are now aware of the fact that things can go badly wrong in the economy. And so there's, I suspect, some lingering anxiety, which is not without foundation.
More coming from outgoing Fed Governor Daniel Tarullo later in the program, including what he thinks are some bumps in the economic road ahead. On Wall Street today, a little bumpy. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here with the geopolitical economy question of the day. How's it going to go down at Mar-a-Lago later this week when Chinese President Xi Jinping meets with President Trump? Trump spent a good part of his campaign, you'll remember, beating up on Beijing over its assorted practices in the global economy. Now, though, the White House could maybe use a little geopolitical assistance. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looks at how those negotiations might go.
President Trump has many gripes with China over trade, the valuation of its currency, and its relations with North Korea. But one of these issues may give him particular bargaining power with President Xi, the trade deficit. Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
China sells far more to the United States than it buys from the United States. So that gives the United States a certain amount of leverage.
Trump could threaten to slap tariffs on Chinese imports. Kent Hughes from the Woodrow Wilson Center says there's something else the U.S. has over China.
We are a home to an enormous array of key technologies that China wants to acquire in one way or another.
Hughes says the U.S. could limit Chinese purchases of technologies like robotics or semiconductors and work to stop China from getting the technology illegally. Thing is, Hughes says, China has some negotiating power, too.
There are a whole host of major American companies that do very well in China. And China could say, well, maybe we just won't buy X or Y from American companies and encourage European investment.
Michael Fuchs with the Center for American Progress says if the U.S. takes certain actions against China, well,
that could then create a tit-for-tat process that spirals down into a trade war.
And a trade war would be awful news for the world's top two economies. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
In automotive news today, some kind of meh data. Major car makers reported March sales this morning that came in well below expectations, 500,000 cars below expectations, to be a bit more specific. Not included in that total, because it's not yet a major car maker, was Tesla. The high-end electric car maker reported first quarter sales of just over 25,000 cars, which for them is a lot. And it raised hopes ahead of the much-anticipated release of the more mass-market Model 3 sedan, in theory later this year. But with mass-market models come mass-market expectations, something Tesla has struggled with in the past, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
YouTube is full of videos of people experiencing the dramatic thrill of acceleration in a Tesla, going from 0 to 60 in a matter of seconds.
Oh my god, it was like a roller coaster!
The question now is whether it will be a roller coaster that keeps steadily climbing upward or comes racing back to Earth.
This is really the moment that Tesla's been waiting for all these years. Everything that they've been doing has been leading up to this moment.
Ed Kim, an industry analyst with Auto Pacific, says after bringing two high-performance electric vehicles to market, Tesla's now testing its brand against mid-price cars.
Consumers that really want something different, really want something unique that represents a different way of doing business. And for those people, Tesla represents exactly that.
But Tesla has yet to prove that it can deliver on higher production targets while also meeting quality and service expectations.
Tesla has never had a particularly good reputation for quality and reliability for the cars that they've built to date, for the Model S and the Model X.
Sam Abu El Samad is a senior analyst with Navigant Research. He says some of the service issues a luxury buyer might overlook might not be forgiven in the more competitive landscape.
That's going to be really hard. I think a lot of customers, if they start seeing quality problems, are going to walk away from their pre-orders.
On top of that, Abu El Samad says legacy car makers are moving quickly with their own EVs, which now feature the same 200-mile charge radius as the Model 3. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Ronco, the company behind the Chop-O-Matic food processor, if you remember that, or the Pocket Fisherman, or the smokeless ashtray, to name just a couple of things it has done, is looking to raise money. 5 million shares being sold to the public, hoping to net $30 million. But forget what Ronco did for beef jerky making technology. It really helped build the advertising method we all know and love so well, the infomercial. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
The following is a paid program brought to you by Ronco.
No, it's not. Still Marketplace. Although, this may sound familiar.
This Showtime rotisserie and barbecue is now priced under $100.
Admit it, we've all watched infomercials. The half-hour ads that repeat over and over. They exist because TV networks have a lot of time to fill, and they'll sell some blocks of it for cheap.
They will literally accept any kind of programming that doesn't get them into trouble with the Federal Communications Commission.
Eugene Secunda teaches media at NYU. In a former life, he had an ad agency that made infomercials. He says they've evolved from just a guy pitching on camera to minor celebrities and elaborate sets. But repetition remains key. Lars Perner teaches marketing at the Marshall School of Business at USC.
The idea here is volume, that you record the program and then you run it over and over and over again, so long as you get the sales that you have targeted.
Call now, until they do. Thomas Ordahl is a brand consultant with Landor. He says infomercials are now part of a bigger strategy. The products aren't just sold on TV, they're sold online and in stores.
That is certainly a shift in the approach in the last 20 years, is the ability to turn these into more of brand building exercises than just product sales exercises.
But that's not all. Ronco is even using its stock sales to get you to its product. Buy enough shares, no joke, you get a free rotisserie oven. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace. Coming up.
If you got sick and you, I can't go to work today, they didn't come back.
Infrastructure jobs back in the old days. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 13 points on this Monday, less than a 0.1% to open the quarter, closed at 20,650. The NASDAQ off 17, about 0.3%, 58.94. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points, about a 0.1%, 23.58 there. Cars, we told you about Ford. Rattled down 1.7% today. Fiat Chrysler off almost 5%. General Motors, whose sales were up, took a big hit along the rest of them, dipped 3.3%. Tesla, though, after those 25,000 cars were sold, flashed up 7.25%. Banks faltered as falling bond yields depressed interest rates. Citigroup down 0.25%. J.P. Morgan Chase down about 0.3% today. Bond prices, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell. 2.32% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. More now from our interview with outgoing Fed Governor Daniel Tarullo. The bit where we talked about what comes next for the Fed and the financial system and for this economy. It starts with this question. Is it true that you had decided to step down from the Fed even before the election?
Yes, pretty much. In fact, a couple of years ago, I had thought this was getting to be about enough. I had basically decided that it was about the right time to go and the spring would be about the right time.
Do you have concerns, though, with what seems to be the deregulatory environment in Washington? Certainly members of Congress and some folks at the White House have talked about changing Dodd-Frank and doing what they can to loosen some of the restrictions on the financial sector.
Well, sure. I would have concerns about some directions that some of those impulses might go. But having said that, there are also some things which I think could command a pretty broad consensus across party lines. I mean, relaxing some of the restrictions on community banks, raising some of the Dodd-Frank thresholds for the size of banks that have to be covered by particular regulations. And again, it's important to note that the most important thing for us to emphasize is the stability and the resiliency of our very largest institutions, because it's those banks whose problems, whether idiosyncratic or systemic, can threaten to bring down the whole system.
You're going to give a speech tomorrow. It's been billed as your farewell address at Princeton. I imagine you're going to outline what you'd like to see happen with financial regulation in this country. Give us a quick sneak preview. I won't tell anybody.
Sure. I'm going to, as you can imagine from our conversation, I'm going to emphasize the importance of capital and of keeping capital high, because that is a buffer against losses that may come from unexpected sources. You know, Kai, it's not as if there's not room for change in Dodd-Frank. There was never an opportunity to have a technical amendments bill to Dodd-Frank the way most major pieces of legislation have. So it's not surprising there are things that could be changed. I just hope that people don't rush into changing things without evidence, and that people remember there was a reason why all these new regs were put in place. And that reason are those dramatic times in late 2008, early 2009 that we were talking about.
Let me get Rumsfeldian on you here for a minute. What is the unknown in the financial sector that keeps you up at night as you leave?
Well, I would say, of course, by definition, you don't know the unknown. And so you just kind of have a generalized middle of the night angst that you can't totally pin down. There's always the possibility, right, of the creation of new asset classes with new funding vulnerabilities that over time turns out to be problematic.
So, let me ask you actually about that.
Yeah.
In other words, it's Wall Street creativity, right? New asset classes, things that Wall Street innovates and says, hey, this is a great new idea.
Right. Subprime securitization, right. You know, in its new avatar.
Right.
Of course, we can't say it won't happen. But there, I think the oversight and monitoring processes that the Fed and the Treasury Department, and for that matter, a lot of private academic economists have put in place, will at least help draw our attention to those things. So I think when you talk about the unknown, I think we probably need to worry about operational risks, cybersecurity risks, and I would put cyber right at the top of my list of concerns, because that is a different kind of world and one in which our regulators and supervisors don't have as much experience with as they do with overseeing sound underwriting practices for lending, for example.
Daniel Tarullo is soon to be ex-member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
President Trump, as you might have heard, has an infrastructure plan. About all we know about it for sure is that the White House is banking on $150 billion in tax incentives to generate a total of $1 trillion in private infrastructure investment. And after that, the logic goes, will come the jobs. Once upon a time, though, infrastructure basically was this country's job. The Great Depression, public works, and the New Deal, when the government put millions of Americans to work building stuff. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner went to Northern California looking for lessons the New Deal might hold for today.
In Northern California, there's a very big dam. No, not the one you saw in the news this winter, the one with the broken spillway. This one was built during the greatest economic crisis this country has ever faced.
California's mighty Shasta Dam is ready to generate its first power. Shasta is the second largest dam in America.
Shasta is a monumental dam built during the Great Depression, like Hoover Dam and Grand Coulee. Infrastructure that was fundamental to developing the western United States. Shasta is a key part of California's plumbing and helped make the state an agricultural powerhouse. If you stand at the base of the Shasta Dam spillway and look up to the top of the dam, about 600 feet, you feel really, really small.
We're looking at 6.5 million cubic yards of concrete.
That's 15 million tons installed by men desperate to work, says Don Bader. He's with the Bureau of Reclamation, the agency that oversees federal dams. During Shasta's construction from the late 30s into the 40s, Bader says there were jobs, jobs, jobs.
Peak workforce was 4,500 folks, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The overall numbers was about 13 to 15,000 different workers worked here over the course of the seven-year period.
Essential paychecks, given that unemployment had reached a terrifying 25% only a few years before. As many as 2 million Americans drifted from town to town during those years searching for work. New Deal historian Jason Scott Smith.
Roosevelt and his advisors saw that building what they called socially useful infrastructure would be a central part of how they could do this, how they could drive unemployment down, put the nation back to work, and get something tangible and long-lasting out of this investment.
All right, hold on.
Not far from Shasta Dam, I catch a ride with three 80-somethings.
This was Little Reno there, a 24-hour bar.
Is that where Little Reno was?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
And then the Dam Shack was there.
Oh, wow, you can see the mountain.
These guys call themselves the Dam Kids because their parents either built the dam or ran businesses in the boom towns that sprouted up. In 1939, Barbara Cross's family piled into an old Chevy truck with all their belongings. They drove here from a small Oklahoma college town, 1,800 miles, because her dad needed work. The first month, Cross says, she, her two siblings, and her parents lived in a tent. Her mother was appalled.
Most of the women were not impressed. It was hard living. They didn't have running water. It was pretty primitive for them.
Del Hebert's dad built a grocery store in one of the boom towns here. He says the dam employed a lot of skilled construction workers, but there were plenty of jobs for the unskilled as well, men who broke rock and hauled brush in triple-digit heat.
All they wanted was people that were willing to work. And nobody asked, how much do I get an hour? They just says, I want a job, give me a job.
An estimated 14 workers died building Shasta Dam. That was a vast improvement over Hoover, where some 100 men died amid workplace conditions that would never pass OSHA standards today. Ruth Ann Kobe's father worked at both dams.
If you got sick and you, I can't go to work today, they didn't come back because the job was taken up.
So you couldn't take a sick day?
No, there was no sick day.
Worker protections, environmental oversight, much has changed since the 1930s. Harvard economist Edward Glaser warns against taking lessons from that era for today.
I think it's fundamentally a mistake to think of infrastructure as a job creation program.
Glaser says today's infrastructure projects don't need as many unskilled workers. We're not literally moving mountains anymore. And even if we did, we've got more technology to do it, the kind that calls for skilled labor, which, by the way, is in short supply right now. The infrastructure we need right now is mostly repairs and upgrades, not glistening new monuments or fundamentally new systems like the interstate.
The benefits of connecting America were huge. Today, we have relatively good connections as long as we maintain them. And so it's not that you can't do anything around the margins, but the benefits are always going to be much smaller.
Smaller, but necessary. That California dam with the broken spillway, Oroville, it won't take tens of thousands of workers or years to fix it. But to the people who fled their homes in fear of massive flooding, the benefits of that infrastructure job are priceless. In Northern California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that either good branding is really, really hard, or Verizon and Yahoo are just doing it wrong. Despite the gigantic security breaches that have come to light since Verizon announced its intention to buy Yahoo's core assets for about $5 billion, the deal is still going ahead. But branding being everything, Business Insider reported today that the company, soon to be formally known as Yahoo, is going to be renamed when combined with Verizon's AOL division. It shall henceforth be called Oath. Yeah, Oath. I don't know. All right, we got to go. First day of the second quarter is in the books. The Dow off 13 points, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ off 17 points, about 0.3% there. S&P 500 gave back 3 points. We'll call that a tenth percent as well. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.